Hey, everybody. My name's June Christensen, and I'm from Mounds, Oklahoma. And it is a real pleasure and privilege for me to be here. And I first off want to thank Pat and the committee that invited me. And thank you all for being so warm and generous and loving, as you always are, no matter where I go. And I want to thank Linda for being my companion this weekend, for picking me up at the airport. It's truly an experience to get to go, and I had to write down those names of those people for fear I'd forget them. At my age, I don't remember a great deal of things, but it is a privilege to be here, and it is an honor to get to come to these things. I am a member of the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon. My home group is in Tulsa. Mounds, Oklahoma is about 20 minutes south of Tulsa, about 20 minutes north of Okmulgee. Now, a lot of people know Okmulgee because they heard of Ramona. Ramona was around for many, many years. Ramona was my sponsor when I got here and stayed with me until she died a few years back. I want to thank Charlie for that wonderful talk he gave last night. I thoroughly enjoyed that. And I came here, I qualified for this program because I'm the mother of three alcoholic children, all of them drunk at the same time. And and I did everything that there is to do, known to man, except I didn't ever try Charlie's mother's trick, which was casserole and enemas. And I just feel like if I'd ever got that, if that ever would have come in my mind, that I might have cured them kids before they had to go through a lot of the stuff they had to go through. Of course, I enjoyed Barbara. She was wonderful, and I related to a lot of the things that she said. When she talked about fixing up the outside so she'd feel good on the inside, I know about that because I spent years trying to fix up the outside, make the outside of a family look right, so you wouldn't know what was really going on. And I succeeded at that pretty well, which you'll hear as I go on my story. Of course, you're in for a treat tonight when you hear Clancy, and one of my favorites, Tom, is going to be here in the morning, and you don't want to miss that. I met Tom just as I got on the elevator to come down. He was just getting off. He just arrived, and they're special. These people are special, and you will enjoy it, and I do hope you will come and participate in everything that's offered here this weekend. Again, my thanks, my genuine thanks for letting me be here. I suffer from a disease called alcoholism, and I don't drink. And that disease took a family such as mine and completely and totally bankrupt us and destroyed us in every area of our life. My husband that I live with today is not an alcoholic. He doesn't drink, never did. But before this disease, it crept into my family so slowly and so suddenly. And before it got through with us, it had absolutely destroyed a family of people. All of us so sick in our own way, and none of us were able to see until we got here to this program and with you. And I have a real special love for this program called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I call myself a Big Book Al-Anon. I was brought up on that Big Book. And I'm happy about that. I'm proud about that. And because the program of Alcoholics Anonymous gave me back three children. And it gave my family a healing. The program of Al-Anon came into my life, and through those two programs, a family that was completely destroyed has been healed. And so that's what I'm going to talk to y'all a little bit about this morning, is my family, what happened with us, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. And I want to start by saying that I didn't grow up in alcoholism. I grew up in a home in a real small farm community right south of Tulsa. My daddy was very prominent in his business. He was a farmer, and it was very successful. It was a very old family in that little community, and we were a proud family, very proud. Now, I grew up in a Christian home where my mama took us to church every time the doors opened. Southern Baptist, and she was strict. There wasn't any cards, there wasn't any smoking, there wasn't any drinking, there wasn't any violence, there wasn't any cussing, there wasn't anything in my family that would cause me to do the things I did later on down the road. And I had one sister, and she's 6 years younger than me, And she's my best friend today. We all live in kind of a commune, you know, we all live right together. My sister lives a quarter mile down the road from me, and she's got four beautiful daughters that are my lovely little nieces, and they have little grandbabies running around. And I tell you, it's a joy, my family's a joy and a delight. We're the kind of family. We grew up being the kind of family that if one of us got cut, we all bled. And so as I began to go through the things and suffer through the things that I did with my children, my family was always there to support me, and I'm so thankful for that. My daddy was my safety net. I tell you right now that when my daddy was in the room with me or when my daddy was around with me, I was safe and I was comfortable in my home. That's the way I grew up. My daddy had a way of making things happen with a dollar bill. And it just seemed like, you know, as I look back, I think no wonder I thought I could buy the things that I needed to buy and the things I needed to fix, I could buy them with money because that's the way I was reared. And so when I was 17 years old, my people like to die and I up and got married. And I married a family of people that lived down the road from us. And they were as different from mine as daylight is from dark. And when Charlie stood up here last night and talked about them whiskey stills, I know a little bit about that because that first family I married into had a whiskey still and made whiskey out in their barn, out in their backyard, and they run whiskey and they run from the law. And they, Lord, they were exciting. They didn't have a... They didn't go to church. There wasn't a one of them that ever darkened the door of the church house. There wasn't a Bible nowhere in the house. That mama smoked cigarettes and drank beer, and they had beer in the refrigerator. And there was True Confessions. She read them True Confession magazines, and they played cards. And they had a life completely separated from anything I'd ever known. And I couldn't wait to get out there on that hill and move in with that bunch. And I lived out there with them for 9 years. And before they got through with me, I'm going to tell you what. Now, I did a lot of things for the first time in that family. My husband started drinking when I had lived with him out there for 3 months. His mom allowed us how it was my fault. And I thought that if they said it, it was. And I tried to do all the things that we try to do to straighten someone out from drinking. You know, I joined him. I went with him to the honky-tonks. I started having babies 9 months and 11 days after that marriage. I had my first child, a little girl named Regina. 17 months later, I had Pat, and 17 months later, I had Mike. And I'd leave my babies with anybody and everybody I could find so I could go hunt that man. And I hunted him, and I hunted him, and he knew, I don't know why I kept hunting him, because he wouldn't come home. We'd just get into a fight. But I honky-tonked with him, I did all the things, and then sometimes in desperation I'd decide I'd go back to the roots of my raising, and I'd take my little family and I'd go back to church. And I tried to make him stop, and I didn't do it. I couldn't get it done. I didn't know that he had a disease called alcoholism. I thought he was sorry, low-life, lily-livered, yellow-bellied, everything you can think of. I thought that's what he was. I figured how he didn't love me and them kids enough to straighten up his life, and I just didn't understand him. I just didn't understand. And the sad part about that is I moved home a lot of times. You know, I'd go home, stay a week or two, and then I'd go back. And my husband was a violent drunk. He just beat the far out of me all the time. He just whipped me like a dog. And I'd go home, and I'd stay a while, and then I'd come back. And I didn't have to live like that. See, I didn't have to live that way because my family was financially able to take care of me and those kids, and they were more than willing. They were more than willing, but somehow in my sickness, I stayed. And I stayed until he beat me almost literally to death, and that was 9 years later. And my daddy came to me, and he told me he'd moved me down in the field right across the road from him in a little house that he owned. And he said, if you want to come home, June, I'll put you and the kids up. And so I came home 9 years after I married that man. I came home again, and I was 25 years old, and I allowed to tell my life was over. Had three little old snot-nosed kids. I was living down there in the middle of an alfalfa field. My daddy had an eye on me like an eagle. My daddy did not, he was an old-fashioned man. He did not believe in women working. I had no skills. I had graduated high school. That was all in the world I had going for me. And so I figured that was it. I was stuck down there from the rest of my life. And my daddy said, now, June, here's what I'm going to do with you. I'm going to give you a job. And your job is you stay home, take care of these babies,
said, no, I'll pay you for that. And he did. He put money in my bank account every week of the world. And they watched me with an eagle eye, I'm here to tell you, because they didn't allow no foolishness of no kind. And so my life changed. Believe me, my life changed. Well, God has a way of working things out. You know, I had down there where we live in Leonard, Oklahoma, it was probably 200, maybe 300 people lived in that little old farming community, you know, everybody out in the country like that. And my little boy, my youngest little boy, set our place on fire one time. He set that yard on fire, and of course word spreads, yard's on fire. Well, what they do, they get on the phone, they ring up all the neighbors. Neighbors get in the pickup, bring a tow sack and a bucket of water, and they beat the fire out with a tow sack and bucket of water. And I bet y'all don't do that down here, do you? That's how we did it. And so there was a young man had moved in that community, just lived over a mile from us, and he came with his bucket of water and his tow sack. And I set my eyes on him right fast. And he was a little cowboy, and just what I always wanted. And so I knew him about 3 months, and he came to me one night, and he asked me to marry him. We never had even had a date. And he asked me to marry him, and I said, yeah. And he told me he loved my children. He loved my children, and most especially he loved my little boys, because they were little country kids. Now, I'm going to tell you, they could do a lot of things. And that man had 2 kids. He had a little girl 5 and a little girl 4, and I had 1 5 and 1 6 and 1 7. And we got married. And we started out on a road of, gosh, we were in love. You know, we loved each other, and he loved my little old kids. And we were happy, and once again, I knew that feeling of safe and comfortable. And we had a lot of hopes and a lot of dreams for the future, and alcohol was not one of them. Alcohol certainly never figured into this picture. There was no alcohol drinking in that home. Once again, we were going to church. We were trying to, you know, Charlie said it last night, you raise some kids in a Christian environment, and somehow or other, everybody stands up here, says that, and they turn out drinking. And I've often wondered if maybe that wasn't it. I don't know. But but anyhow, that's how we started out our lives. Now, I had a problem, and I've always had a problem with pride and ego. And you wouldn't believe that from the way I had lived in those first 9 years. But I lived and run with such a fast crowd and had gained such a bad reputation. But I got real proud of myself when I married that man and had started out on this new life and had different kind of friends, different caliber of living. And I got really proud of myself. Now, down in Bixby, Oklahoma, there's a little paper that came out every Friday. And so about every Wednesday, I wrote an article. And I took it down there, and I wrote it about one of my kids, because my kids showed hogs and cows, and we showed horses, and they were in FHA and all that kind of stuff, you know. And they were always winning awards. So I would take this article down to the paper, and I stretched it a little bit. I told the basic truth, and then I stretched it on out there a little bit, put a picture in there if I had one handy of whatever it was they won. And I always said, child of Carl and June Christensen. Because see, the reason I did that, I knew that only 10 miles down the road was this natural family, them kids, and I wanted to gig them just a little bit if I could, you know, let them know how good I was doing. And that came back to haunt me years later, and I'll tell you about that a little bit later on in my story. So that's how we started. And we were on farm, and my husband was farming, and the kids worked. We worked hard. You know, my little old boys were making field hands by the time they were 8, 9, 10 years old. They were driving tractors and combines. And one of my husband's little girls moved in with us, and we raised her. And so there was 4 permanent kids, and in the summer there was 5. And it was a good life. You know, we had a good life. And in the meantime, we were showing these animals and doing all this stuff. And my kids began to get into some trouble at school, and I began to tell lies, and I began to connive and cheat and hide things from my husband, I didn't realize then, you know, I didn't want to make any trouble. I just didn't want to make any trouble, so I couldn't, and it was so important for me to win the argument, and I knew I wasn't going to win an argument with my husband, so I just kept quiet. I just go get the kid out of trouble at school, tell him to keep your mouth shut, and we went on. And that's kind of how we operated. Now, when my oldest one was Regina, when she was 16 years old, she went to a party one night, and the lady called, and my husband answered the phone, and the lady said, "She's up here drunk, and you're going to have to come get her." Well, he went and got her, and my husband had a pretty bad temper. And he brought her home, and I was just wringing my hands, you know, I just didn't know what the tarnation was going to take place. And I never will forget how he slung her down in an old rocking chair, and that old chair just flopped back and forth, and that kid sitting there. And he called her a tramp. And a feeling happened to me right there that night that I had not experienced with this man, and it festered within me for years to come, till I came to you. And I began to resent him. I began to resent him, and I began to blame. See, I don't know about y'all, but it's real important for me to have to blame somebody for what was going on in my family. It was so important, and so I blamed him. I mean, I wasn't going to blame me, and I wasn't going to blame the kid, so it was that stepdaddy's fault. Now, my husband had adopted my kids when we'd been married 2 years, and he was good to my kids. He was good to my family, and he loved my family. But in the effort to blame, I covered up the truth, and I rationalized and justified my behavior. It talks about that. I rationalized and I justified my behavior, and the way I did that, I blamed him. If he didn't act like that, I wouldn't have to lie like this, and I wouldn't have to feel like I feel in my belly. And so that was the first instance. Not long after that, the second one was the boy Pat. And Pat had worked like a field hand all those years, and we had not paid him wages. And when he was 16, Carl went to town and bought him a brand new car. And Pat got a ticket up in Tulsa and got thrown in jail. Now, Carl told him he'd get him out one time, and that was it. And he stuck to that, you know, and I told him that too, but I just kept on getting them out, and lying and getting them out. But Carl went up here and got that boy out, and he brought him home and set him down, and he said, "Now tell me what happened here." Well, now I'm going to tell you what that kid said. Now he said, "Now it wasn't my fault," and he was looking right at me, directing it right at me. "Mama," he said, "it wasn't my fault. It was not me." He said, "I was going down South Sheridan on my way home, minding my own business. I had had one beer at this girl's house at this party, and a car just exactly like mine passed me going about 100 miles an hour. Why," he said, "by the time the cop got there, they just pulled me over and gave me this ticket." Well, I fell for it. You know, I looked at him and I immediately want to go to town, go get my daddy, go to town, and we're going to do something to straighten that police force out up in Tulsa, because they are picking on them kids. And we're going to straighten it out. And my husband, I'll never forget, he looked at me and he said, "June, that boy is lying through his teeth." And I felt that feeling again, you know, and I felt that feeling again, and that resentment began to grow. And so that's how things began, were going on in our house. That's how it started. Well, the kids, Pat and Regina, every once in a while they'd get mad and they'd leave home. And I'd go hunt them up and I'd beg them and they'd come back. And there was a lot of conflict going on in that house. And it was so necessary. Lord, it was so necessary to look good when we stepped out. We looked like the all-American family when we stepped out of that house. And we looked good. And there was some stuff going on inside that house that was sick. And I didn't know what was wrong with us. I didn't know what was wrong with me. But it was like two different sets of people. What was going on inside. And we looked so good that we won them an award up in Washington, D.C. one year. They awarded me and Carl for being Farm Family of the Year. And I'm going to tell you, there was some strife going on in that house while I was up there getting, grinning from ear to ear, standing there getting that silver platter they gave me. And my kids were running amok down home with my mom and daddy looking after them. It was crazy. Regina and Pat moved away and went to college. And in the summer of 1971, at about 2 o'clock in the morning, that telephone rang, and it was the law. And the law told me that they had arrested my little daughter, and they had her in custody in Tulsa County Jail on a drug possession. And Lord, I tell you what, I thought I was going to die, and I got Carl up and told him, and he raged, and he raged, and he raged. and I felt that feeling, and I didn't like it. It didn't feel good. And we got that boy up, and we asked him if he knew anything at all about what was going on with that little girl, and he said he didn't know anything about it, and he went back to bed. At 5 o'clock in the morning, they knocked on my door, and they picked that boy up and handcuffed him, and they loaded him up and took him to Tulsa County Jail. And I got two kids locked up in Tulsa County Jail on Friday morning and on Thursday morning. And we went up and told my daddy, because my daddy knew what to do. My daddy had the money to fix things, and he knew what to do. And I want to tell you people right now, we hung our head in shame for a long, long time in that little town. Because in 1971, that wasn't happening down there in that little rural community of Bixby, Oklahoma. And we were the first family that the drugs and the alcohol touched in that little community. And we were so ashamed of what had happened to us. And that Bixby Bulletin came out. I never will forget it the longest day I live. It was right there on the front page. It said, Pat and Regina Christensen, son and daughter of Carl and June Christensen, were arrested on Thursday morning and are now held in custody in Tulsa County Jail. And I had not been the one that took that article down there. And I tell you right now, I cut my subscription to that paper off and I ain't read it to this day. I've been mad at them ever since for putting that in there. I mean, I had carried them some good news all those years, and they put that tacky thing in there about my little kids. But at looking back, you see, God has a way of showing us what we really are and what our motives really are. You know, it's important to know what your motives are. And my motive was not good in the days I was doing all that bragging about my kids, and it came back to haunt me. Well, now, you know, we had to come up to the courthouse to get them kids out of that jam. And so, Mom and Daddy, I'll never forget it, we all loaded up. And I told Carl how to act. You know, I was always telling Carl how to act. I tell you what, I spent years telling Carl how to act and tried to make that man mind me. I just allowed his how if he would act. You know, I always thought I had the answer. If I just could get him to act like I want him to act, everything would be fine. Now, I told Carl, don't go up there and act ugly and stomp around in them boots and that hat and say things in front of Mom and Daddy that's going to upset them, going to upset me. And I go up there and act like this and act like that. See, my husband don't own a pair of shoes. He's a cowboy. He is a full-fledged ranch cowboy. Wears boots, wears hats. He wears Wrangler jeans and a jacket. That's his funeral clothes, his marrying clothes, his working clothes. I mean, that's it. It don't make any difference where we go. That's what Carl wears. And so there he was up there that day, this little short outfit, just stomping around, acting ugly, cussing. Ooh, I was mad. And Mom and Daddy having to listen to all that stuff. And see, what was happening was how I wanted people to perceive us. They were seeing how we really were. They were seeing how we really were. Secret was out. We were not that little all-American family that never said anything, never did anything. They knew. And Carl went up there and acted ugly, and my daddy took the money, and he got those kids out of that jam. And we come home, and Pat and Regina moved on. They went away. Pat went away to college. Pat went on. Regina went back into her second year of college, and Carl and I moved. We did that geographical cure, you know. We owned a ranch down in Okmulgee County, not too far from where we were living at the time, and we moved. And we had that one kid left at home, and he was with us. And his drinking, he was rodeoing and showing horses a lot back in those days. And so he was always gone. He was gone an awful lot. And finally he left home too. And his drinking began, and it progressed to a state that they all were gone. And what was going on with me and Carl was it kind of turned into best way I know to describe it is nothingness. You know, we didn't argue a lot about it. We just got real silent. We lived on a real working ranch, and we worked side by side. We showed horses. We raised some quarter horses, some cutting horses, and we did a lot of traveling with them horses, and we ran a lot of steers, and we worked like partners. You know, we worked side by side. We put up a lot of hay. I knew how to drive a tractor. I knew how to ride a horse. I knew how to doctor a cow. I knew how to do all that stuff. And my husband and me were compatible until it came to those kids, and we could not discuss it, and so we didn't. And what my husband would say when something would come on television about drugs, alcohol, and that kind of abuse, I wouldn't look. And my husband would say, now, June, if you want to hide your head in the sand, you go ahead, but I'm going to, they're drinking. They're drinking, and that's what's going on. And I had that feeling this morning just churn inside me. It was his fault. Had to be his fault. I knew it was his fault. He worked them too hard. He wasn't their natural daddy. It was a million things. It had to be his fault. And there was a separateness there somewhere that I don't really know how to explain today. But I blamed him. I blamed him. I blamed him. Lord, I blamed him nearly into his grave. And I blamed him nearly out of a marriage. You know, I blamed him till we did things to each other. And that period of time, from 1971 until I come in this program in 1987, that man and me did things to each other that no marriage should be able to survive. And outside of these rooms, it wouldn't have. It just wouldn't have. I learned a lot of things about forgiveness and storing resentment and things that I was guilty of. And I had to look at me. And that's the only way in the world. You know, my husband and me, we're going to be married 36 years this August. You know, I read that banner last night and I thought, well, Carl would he'd relate to that because he thinks I am a miracle since I got here and got off his back. And he is eternally grateful, y'all, I want to tell you. And he always says, tell him I send them my best, and that's me. He thinks that's what he thinks today, you know. But back in those days, you know, things were so terrible, and my little boys had come home, and my boys come home, and they got to looking really weird. I'm going to tell you right now, they didn't look like them kids that I raised. My Regina, she looked pretty good. She'd come home, she'd always look pretty good. And she didn't, but Pat and my Lordy, they'd come up that long driveway. We lived right square dab up in the middle of a section, one road in and one road out. And them boys would come home, and sometimes they'd have funny looking folks with them, and sometimes they'd just be by themselves. And they had their hair way down to here, and they'd have headbands, and they'd have earrings, and they got to looking weird. And my husband would just flat dab walk outside, and he'd say, "You just get the hell off my land." And they would. And sometimes, though, he'd see them coming far enough that he'd go get in the barn, and he wouldn't come out of the barn. He just didn't even want to look at them. And they'd come in, and they'd want money. And I'd lay that money in their hand, and then they'd leave. And then I would do something really stupid, like I would go and say to Carl, "They were doing just real good. They said they sorry they missed you, wish they could have seen you." And I told them the same thing, you know. And I just thought I was always doing that kind of stuff. And so I finally figured out that maybe if I could send them somewhere. You know, if I could send them boys off somewhere and somebody else would straighten them out. So I got Pat to join the Army. I figured the Army would straighten him out. So I got him lined up to join in the Army. And the Army took him and sent him off to Germany. And he didn't do real good over there. In fact, he didn't do good at all. I got a letter after he'd been gone about 2 years, and they told me he was locked up in a hospital over there with a heroin addiction. And Lana, I didn't know what to do. I never will forget it. You know, I had a place in my bedroom there on the ranch, and it was dark, and there was a little hole kind of like between the wall and the bed. And I'd go back there and pull the drapes and shut the door, and I'd lay down on that floor. And I'd lay there, and I'd sleep, and I'd sleep, and I'd sleep. And I just thought I was tired. And I went in that bedroom, and I laid there in that little hole in the floor where I stayed. And I started praying to the God of my childhood. And the only way I knew how to pray was to make these deals, you know. And because I figured God was doing something to me for how I had acted in those 9 years I'd lived that past life. And so I made these promises, you know, "God, if you'll do this, I'll do that. And if you'll bring my boy home and get him sober, I won't never do that again." And see, I didn't know anything about the God that y'all have taught me about. Now, I knew about the God I'd heard about all my life. But I didn't know about this God of compassion. I didn't know about this God that loves without judgment. I didn't know that. like I do today. And so I bargained with God, and I knew that boy was coming home, and because they said they was going to send him home, and I didn't know what in the tarnation I was going to do. And by that time, I was a physical wreck. I had done all the things that we do in this disease. I was buying things. I was fixing things. I was running around getting them out of jail. I was paying their rent. I was picking up their bad checks. I was bailing them out. And I was lying. And I was conniving. And I was cheating. I was taking money from my husband. I was not asking any permission. I was not talking to him about nothing. I was running on, you know, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous talks about self-will run riot. And I was so into self, I could not see. And so I was doing all these things, trying to fix these kids. And so I knew I couldn't, I had had two major surgeries by that time on my back, and one on someplace else. And I was taking heart medicine. I had an ulcer that was the size of that. And the doctor was a good friend of ours, and I went up there to him and I said, Tom, I need to go to the hospital and I need to go on this day, and I need to stay 8 days, and you run tests on me and figure out what's the matter with me. And he said, June, what goes on inside? And I said, nothing. Everything's fine, Tom. Well, Lord, he knew better. He was doctoring Mike, who had shot himself in the leg in a drunken stupor about a week before. He was down at our house a lot. He knew that Carl and I were not able to even talk about these kids. Tom knew, and I couldn't tell him the truth. You know, I didn't know how to be honest either. I couldn't say what was really happening in my family. I knew that kid was coming home, and I knew I couldn't be there. I knew that they was not going to come to the hospital and argue over the bed of a dying woman. And so the best place for me to be was piled up in a bed in the hospital. And I didn't have anything wrong with me, but I went up there with all these physical ailments, got Tom to put me in the hospital, and that's where he kept me for 8 days. The boy came home. Sure enough, they didn't have fight and argue. I could lay there, and Pat went on. And I went home. And there was nothing wrong with me. They didn't find anything wrong with me. And so Pat was kind of hanging around home, kind of hanging around Bixby, kind of in and out. So I got him a job in Calipatra, California. I sent him off out there to a feedlot. And he was doing pretty good out there. And so I sent Mike out there too. You see, I don't know why it was that I had to separate myself from what I was looking at. I could not look at what was going on with my kids. You know, I look back and I think often when I'm standing up here at a podium like this and I'm talking to y'all, you must think I was a lousy mama, but I'm telling you right now, I was not a lousy mama. If you're a mama of my caliber, you're the kind of parent that'll kill a kid. You'll kill them stone cold dead, loving them too much. And I was that kind of mama. See, I was the kind of mama that if I could just put the money in their hand and send them on down the road, I didn't have to look at what was going on. And I was not capable of looking at what was going on in my house and with my kids and in my life. I could not do it. And so I laid the money in their hand and I made them promise me. Will you promise me if I give you this money that you won't drink no more? Well, of course they promised me that. You know, I know today that my kids did not set out with the intent to do harm. And there isn't an alcoholic in this room, nor an Al-Anon in this room, that ever set out to do the harm we did. I never set out to do what I did, and neither did you. But somehow in this disease calls us, and we answer, and we do harm, and we don't mean to. And I'd make them little kids promise me when I'd hand them that dollar, will you promise me you won't do that anymore? Will you not drink anymore? And of course they promised me, because that disease was calling them and they needed that money to go buy that stuff, and I was the one that was giving it to them. I absolutely kept them loaded up on it for all those years. They never had to go without because I gave them the money. They never had to own the responsibility. I had to own the responsibility when I got to you all for what I did to my family. See, my family, I used to say, oh Lord, look what you're doing to me. how could you do this to me? How could you do this to me? And I can't say that anymore. I wrecked lives with my self-righteous attitude and that dollar in my hand. With the attitude I had that I knew best, I knew what it took to fix them. And if I could just get them to listen. I was never short on giving out opinions. Never. I don't think ever one time I ever had a kid come to me and say, "Mama, tell me what to do to help me get out of this rut." It was just, "Mama, I need money to pay for this. I need money to pay for that." And I gave it to them and they went on. So I sent both those boys out to Calipatra, California. And while Pat was out there, he got married. And pretty soon they all came home. It didn't make any difference where I sent them. Somebody always sent them back. I'm telling you right now, it is not easy. It is not easy to stand up, to try to keep up with three drunk kids. I had three drunk kids, and now I got a daughter-in-law that's crazy, and my husband's going around raging, and I'm the only sane person in the crowd, I thought. And I'm going to tell you something, I stayed up nights trying to think of solutions. It was hard. And it just seemed like, the phone would ring. Lord, I'd rather have a snake bite me as hear that phone ring in the middle of the night, because I knew it was bad news. And so I'd take that phone off the hook. So when they couldn't call me. Because once in a while it would ring and I hadn't thought to do that, and my husband would answer, and he'd talk a minute and he'd slam that phone down and he'd say, "He's drunk." God, I hated to hear him say that. I couldn't listen to that. And I felt that old stern feeling in my stomach again, that resentment come up. And I didn't like to feel like that with this man I was living with. I don't know what was happening to us, but we were falling apart. So holidays would roll around, and Lord have mercy, that was the absolute worst time of my life. We didn't come Christmas or Thanksgiving. And Pat, by that time, had got married, had a little old girl, and I took full responsibility for that little family. Now, they didn't have to want for nothing. I took care of everything they needed, and I'd go tell that little old woman, that little wife of his, what do you need? You need this, you need this. She needed a lot of stuff, and she needed high price stuff. I'm still paying Sears, I think, for televisions and washing machines and ice boxes and all that kind of stuff that she had to have. And I now did ask her to lie. Now, I was religious enough not to do that, but I would say things like, "I just assumed Carl didn't know about this." And so she wouldn't tell, because she knew she needed something else next month, and she wasn't about to break the goose that was laying the golden egg. And so holidays were rolling around, and it was coming Thanksgiving, and I knew, and what would happen, I knew they wouldn't show up, and if they showed up, they'd show up, I wouldn't hardly recognize them. Pat and Mike would be, I'd have to get out before Christmas. Most families cook and worry and present and do all that. I spent weeks rounding them up, making them promise, trying to get their faces cleaned up, get their black eyes and their bruises and their cuts and all that kind of stuff, buy them some decent clothes so they'd look good when they got there. So I told Pat to bring the turkey. He said he'd be happy to. Now I want to tell you all this is an experience that I want to share with you, because you don't want to ever do it. Now I told Pat to bring the turkey. He said he'd be tickled to bring the turkey. And Thanksgiving morning, there was 35 people coming to my house. Thanksgiving morning rolled around, his wife called me in tears. "June," she said, "I don't know what in the tarnation he did. He's gone. He's been gone for days. He took the turkey when he left here. I do not know where he is." Well, my boy Pat was drunk, but he wasn't dumb. Now, he took that turkey down to a man that smoked turkeys down by my daddy, and he said, "Now, if I don't get back, you take this turkey to my granddaddy on Thanksgiving morning. He'll deliver it to my mother," which is exactly what happened. Pat woke up in a blackout drunk somewhere up in Missouri. That's kind of how the holidays went. Christmas was worse. Christmas, I'd get out and I'd shop and I'd buy all these presents and I'd disguise my handwriting. And I became their personal shopper. Now, Regina would usually show up with something, but Pat and Mike never did. So I'd go buy, and usually a book, and I'd write in there, "To Daddy with lots of love, Pat." And same thing in Simon Mike's name. And then I'd get around and watch real hard, watch like a hawk, for the boys to come. And they'd come, and I'd run off and get them off to their self, tell them, "I got your daddy a present. Now when he opens it, act like you saw it before and don't act surprised." And then my job was to be the monitor. to see how people treated my kids, most especially Carl. And Carl, he'd open that book up and he'd look at it, and a look of utter disgust would come on his face because he knew what I had done. You know, he knew what I had done. And he'd slam that book down, and I'd say to myself, "You ruined my Christmas again, Carl. It's your fault. If you had just accepted that present, if you'd just go up and act like everything was okay, everything would be okay." It was always Carl's fault. So that's how things were going along, and the craziness that was going on in my house. And one my boy Mike, he called me one day up in Tulsa and said he's going to shoot himself. And I said, "Lord, don't do it till I get there. Wait till I get up there. Now I'm going to talk him out of it. I'll bring some money and I'll talk him out of it." So I got my money in one hand, and I kept money hid, and I got my money in one hand, and I drove as fast as I could up there in an old house. I never forget the place he lived. It was just like a hole in the wall. It was terrible. And I walked in there, and there he was, and I gave him the money, and I said to him, "Mike, don't shoot yourself. How much money would you have not to shoot yourself?" And he priced it, and I paid him, and he didn't shoot himself. And so I put him in a pickup and sent him off up into Ohio, Marietta, Ohio. And he stayed up there where his drinking and his drugging got worse. And that's what was going on with the other two. Regina by that time was a nurse. She was working a lot, and like Barbara talked about this morning, she worked a while in that profession, and pretty soon she became a bartender in a bar. And that's where she stayed until she sobered up. Pat was a spray pilot. He was flying spray planes. Lord, I don't know how he stayed alive and did that. I do not know how that boy drank and flew those things, except that by God's grace, he did it. Charlie talked about that last night. The coincidences, the miracles that happened with us. But anyway, that was how our family was. Me and Carl were getting worse and worse. And one night that phone rang about 11 o'clock, and it was my boy Mike up in Ohio. And he said to me, "Mama," something has happened here to me tonight. He said, "A man came to my house," and he said, "I got out on my knees, and God has saved my soul." And he said, "I'm going to go up here to a little Bible college, and I'm going to become a preacher." And I said, "Lord, son, you can't do that. You didn't even graduate out of high school." See, Mike was locked up in jail when his class graduated, and he hadn't got his diploma. And he said, "Oh, I'm going to do it." And we didn't talk about that very much. We didn't tell folks nothing about that for a while because we wasn't just real sure. But that's exactly what he did. He cleaned himself up. He went up to a little Bible college in Marietta, Ohio, and he told them his story. He took the test that was necessary for him to have his college or his high school diploma. And he entered that little college, and I sent him the money to go on. And he stayed there for 2 years. And after he'd been there a while, he wanted to go to Belfast in Northern Ireland, and he wanted to study with Dr. Ian Paisley and Dr. Bob Jones from over here at Greenville, South Carolina. And he went over there in Northern Ireland in Belfast, and he went to school over there, and he preached all over that country for a year and a half. And I sent him the money it took to go on. And when he came home from Belfast to Northern Ireland, he wanted to come down here to Greenville, South Carolina, and go to school at Bob Jones University, and I sent him the money to go on. And he stayed down here, and he got a degree in theology. And he was preaching everywhere all that time. And a life had truly been transformed. And I believe today with all my heart that that boy got up off his knees that morning or that evening, whatever, and God had truly saved his soul and called him to preach, because he was an excellent preacher. He was a very good preacher. He worked in the jail ministries and places like that, where he knew something about what was going on with these people. But I believe today that he got up an alcoholic, and somehow many of the clergy do not know how to address this issue. And he happened to fall in with a bunch that did not. And that craving came one day through a disappointment in his church, and he picked that snake up one more time, and he bit him. You know, Charlie talked about that last night. He walked down that tunnel, and he went in the wrong door, and he was gone again. But anyway, through all of that, not one time did it ever occur to me to get out on my knees and ask God, "Is this your will?" Oh, you see, it was my will and that kid's will, and I didn't think about anybody else. You know, it talks about people like me in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It talks about the director of the play. It talks about people like me when it talks about that. And I was running that show, and people were coming up to me and they were saying, "Oh, June, you did such a good job." And I thanked them, because somewhere down the line I thought that boy had listened to something I said. And because of something I said, his life had been transformed and he was doing great. And I stuck my head up in the air and I was proud of myself. And I was proud of that boy. Things got a little bit different down at the house. They didn't get a whole lot different down at the house, because it got one kid preaching, two kids drunk. Me and Carl are still kind of at each other. Drunk kids don't like the preacher. Preacher don't like the drunk kids. Carl didn't like any of them hardly. Was barely tolerating me. And so things were getting a little bit better. And so one day, Carl and I sold a ranch and we moved off the farm where we live today. We retired off the farm in the ranch and we moved up to a little 5-acre place and we were building a horse barn. And we heard that spray plane coming. You can hear them long before you see them. And it looked like Pat. Carl went out of the barn to look to see if it was Pat. And it looked like that kid was going to fly that plane right smooth down through that barn. And Carl said, "Lord, have mercy, June, he's drunk." And one time more, I had to look at him and say, "How in the world do you know? He's up there and you're down here. Now, how could you make?" And Carl said, "June, I watched him fly so many times. I know he's drunk." And I was angry again. We went back home down on the ranch. We were still living down there. We went home and the phone rang about 9 o'clock that night. And I want to tell you all what I said. That boy called and he said, "Mama, I've got to have some help." Well, number one, he called the right person, because I was able to help. I knew I could figure out someplace. I had a place figured out just in case they'd ever ask. But you know what I want to tell you about is what I said to that boy that night that just recently. I want to show you the difference in what happens in our disease and what happens in our recovery. I said to him, "Yeah, Pat, I can help you, but don't come down here tonight. Go on over to your granddaddy's and stay. I'll get you tomorrow." Because see, I didn't want to talk to my husband. We couldn't talk. We still could not talk about this disease that was wrecking our home and our lives. And I didn't want to talk about it. So I said, "Go on down to your granddaddy's and stay, and I'll pick you up and take you in the morning." Next morning, I picked that boy up. And I called his wife and told her to get ready. I took Pat and got him some decent clothes. I took him and got his hair cut. I want him to go up to that treatment center looking good. You know, one more time, I want us to look good, not act right. And I told them both what to say all the way up there. I did not want Pat to go in there and talk about us and tell how we really were, because I didn't want the people at that treatment center thinking they were looking at white trash. And so I went in there with them, and I flopping my lip as fast as I could, telling them all about what an outstanding family we were, how we won all these prizes. I took these kids to church all their life. I don't know what happened, you know, but I think my husband had something to do with it, and blah, 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 blah. And they looked at me and told me I was excused, and I could go home, and I didn't need to worry about coming back up there for a while. That was before they started doing Family Week. I took him to St. John's Hospital in Tulsa. And thank God, Pat fell in with a group of people that said to him, "When you get out of here, you got to go to AA. And you got to get a sponsor." And thank God, Pat got one of them old-timey sponsors that said, "It don't make any difference if it's your kid's birthday. You don't miss a meeting. You're going to a meeting, buddy. Where were you last year when that kid's birthday rolled around? You be at a meeting this year, maybe next year you can celebrate." And he shoved that stuff on that boy so hard, and that boy took to this program, and he is, the 29th day of March, he was 12 years sober. And thank God for people like you that helped him through that. Well,
I did not tell Carl that he was allowed to go up there to see that kid. I didn't want him up there. I was afraid secrets would come out, so I didn't say nothing about that. And I went by to get Regina one day and take her up there to see him, and she was all huddled up on the couch, and she was so sick. And Regina suffered with a virus. Y'all know about that kind of virus that you get? And she always had that virus. And I'd go get her stuff, you know, Pepto-Bismol and all that kind of thing, and give her a little money to buy her some soup and stuff. And she was so sick and she couldn't go, and so I went up to the treatment center and I told Pat, I came to get your sister, and she's so sick, Pat, she's got that virus. She had, it took her a long time, but she made it, one day at a time, she made it. So the first thing they did, I've got them all sobered up, see. And so here they come, and they told me that I need to go to a place called Al-Anon. And I never was as shocked in my life. I never will forget it. I said, why don't y'all ask your daddy to go to Al-Anon? I mean, he's the one that acted like the horse's rear end. He's the one that run y'all off. I'm the one that paid your way. I'm the one that put money in your hand. I'm the one that did this. I did that. I fixed things for you. Have y'all forgotten? And they looked me straight in the face and they said to me, Mama, you really do need to go. And I just would never was put out in my life. And I said, I don't think so. And so I didn't go. And they bought me a big book. And they said, well, maybe if you read it, you'll understand. Well, see, I know that there's some stuff about that, but I read that book because they told me up there at that treatment center that my kids had a disease, and the disease was called alcoholism. And if I read this book, I'm going to understand a little bit more about that disease. Now, if I'd have took my kid up there at the hospital and throw him in a bed, and they'd have said, June, your boy's got leukemia, I'd have read everything I could find out about that disease. And I could accept it. I cannot accept what I do not understand. And so I got that book and I read it. I read it from cover to cover. And I saw them in that book. I read that part about where it says the director of the play, why, that was Carl. I wrote his name right out there in the margin. I read that part where it said that they couldn't get honest. Why, that was Mike. I read the part about, I read all that stuff and I put their name out there in the margin. You know, that was them. I knew it was them. The inability to get honest. Well, that was them. They were lying through their teeth. And so that was their problem. You know, I read it and that's how I read the book. I read it and I marked their name in it. Well, the day came I had to go back and change it. But I'll come to that a little bit. Well, I just had to go back and change it. After I got in this program, I began to read that book, and I saw that it was me. You know, it talks about the lack of power is our dilemma. I'm going to tell you all something. I don't know how familiar some of you are with that book, but the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous sings to my soul. It sings to my soul, and it talks about me. It describes me. It says, lack of power is my dilemma. That was my dilemma. I have it wrote down right here in my little book. We were in full flight from reality, or else we were mentally defective. I never forget when I read that. I wrote Carl's name out beside that because I thought he was the mentally defective one. But the time came that I had to go back and scratch his name out and put my own there. See, that talked about me. It talks about my pick struck gold. It talks about the old miner, and it says my pick struck gold. And because my pick struck gold, I was able to take years of bondage and frustration and feel the joy and the love and the freedom that this program has to offer. But that's how I read the book to start with. I read it differently today. I read it in companionship with the Al-Anon literature, and it all sings to my soul. So anyway, got all these kids sobered up, doing pretty good. And then one day I call up in Ohio to see what's going on with Mike, and the preacher told me that Mike was drunk again. And I thought I'd die. And so I did the only thing I knew to do. I immediately got sick. Before the day was out, I couldn't breathe. They had me hauled up to the emergency room. I wasn't able to breathe, couldn't talk. They called my kids to come home.
My boy Pat sat down on the bed beside me and he asked me if I wanted to tell him what was wrong, and I said no. And he said, "Mom, it's Mike, isn't it?" And I, "Yeah." He said, "Is he drinking?" I, "Yeah." "How'd you know?" And he told me about how you can see the relapse coming many times long before the drink is picked up. Many times you can see the relapse coming in people that are Al-Anons like me long before we get back into our old. You know, she talked about that this morning, about her old, my old ways are my first ways. See, it's not easy for me to do what's right. I never knew how to act when I was right. It's not easy for me to do what's right, what y'all told me. This is the hardest thing I ever did in my life. But I had to tell that boy what was going on with Mike. And he got on an airplane and he went the next day and he got that boy and he put him in a treatment center up in Columbus, Ohio. And Mike stayed 2 weeks and he come out. And I called Mike and I sent him a ticket to come home. And he brought his little wife and he came home. And it was during the Labor Day weekend. And he ran amok in my life for 2 weeks. I was literally terrified. I don't know why I even wanted him to come home, because I was so scared that he'd get drunk and people were going to know. Because I had splashed his name all over those newspapers, just like I had done back when they were young, about how he was preaching and how he was going here and he was going there. And once again, I was going to have to look at that stuff and eat that crow, and I didn't want to do that. And so my little sober kids, they threatened that boy with his life if he drank while he was home. And we all went up to the airport to get him, and I told Carl how to act. Now, my husband's not a mental midget, and he don't need me to tell him how to act. But I always thought I was supposed to, and I did. And I told Carl how to act all the way up there, and he didn't do it. And we got up there, he acted ugly one more time. And so when time came to bring that kid back to the airplane to go home, I didn't ask none of them to go. I just took him by myself. And I put him on the plane and his little wife, and I said my goodbyes, and I walked back out in that corridor of Tulsa International Airport, and I leaned up against the wall and I sat down on the floor and I put my head on my knees and I sobbed as if I'd put a corpse on that plane. Because see what I knew that day? That my fix wasn't working anymore. The gig was up, and I did not know how to fix that boy. And I knew I didn't have enough money, and I knew I didn't have any power. And you know, I knew something else, and they talked about, Franklin talked about it last night. I knew in my heart right then, God gives us a free will to choose. And if God gives us a free will to choose, I was going to have to do the same. No amount of money, no amount of power can make a decision for a man. Until such time as you decide to make that decision, nobody will make it for you. And I knew that day. Maybe not verbally, but in my heart I knew it. And I heard a little feet coming running down the corridor, and it was that little old girl of mine. And she was able to get on the plane and tell her little brother and her little sister-in-law goodbye. And she came back out and she sat down beside me right there on the floor of that airport that day. And she put her arms around me and she told me the precious story that you people of Alcoholics Anonymous had told her. And she said, "Mama, today you're going to learn about release. And you're going to learn about surrender right here. And this is where it's going to start for you. And I think you need to go to Al-Anon." And on Tuesday night, I was in my first Al-Anon meeting down in Okmulgee, Oklahoma. Because my kids told me there's a lady down there named Ramona. And I knew Ramona. And she said, "Go down there and Ramona will help you." And I went down there and I walked in that meeting that Tuesday night, and I was scared literally to death. I was lonely. I was frustrated. I was at the end of my rope. I did not know what else in the world to do. And I sat down in a room full of strangers and I listened to what you said. And they told me I've got to do these 12 steps. And I looked at them and I thought, I can whip them out in 30 minutes. That's no job for me. And I got in my car that night and I started home and I said to myself, there's not one thing going on in that meeting that's going to do me any good, and I will not go back. See, I went down there for two reasons, and I went down there to get a kid sober and get a man to mine, and they didn't know how, they didn't tell me that stuff. And I figured if I could get that man to mind me and do what I wanted and get that boy sober, that everything in my life would shape up and be all right. And y'all didn't tell me how to do that. You didn't even suggest to me how to do that. And I went to work the next morning. Regina, by that time, my sister had hired Regina to work, come into her. She gave Regina her first job in sobriety because Regina was virtually unemployable. And she gave her a job, and I was working for my sister at that time. We worked in a little family business. And I went up to the office on Wednesday morning, and Regina, I told her, I ain't going back down there. They don't know anything about what's going on with me. They don't understand this, and I'm not going to do it. And Regina made me promise. She said, Mama, will you promise me? Will you just go 6 weeks? And so I promised her that. I allowed us how I owed her that. And I promised her that I'd go for 6 weeks, and I began to go. And what I found out down there was not what I went to find out, and I found out what kind of a person I was. And that's what I said a while ago when I told you it's the hardest thing I ever had to do in my life. Because I had to look at who I was and what kind of a woman I was. Self-righteous, self-justification. Lord, I knew more than anybody in the world knew. I lied. I cheated. There was stuff down in my heart, deep, dark things down in my heart, the kind of person I was. And that's the kind of stuff that y'all cleaned out. That's the kind of stuff I looked all right when I got down there. Y'all cleaned my spirit out. You cleaned my heart out and made me see who I am. You made me be able to lay down at night and do that 10-step prayer. And I don't do that 10-step prayer saying, God, if you'll get Carl straightened out, everything will be... I have to look at me. See, y'all showed me that, and I didn't know that. And that's what you showed me. And it isn't easy for me to look at me like that. I don't like to. I had to learn to look at that alcoholic, no matter if it was my kid or not, and look at him with compassion and love. And that's the things you showed me to do. So I began to go, and in October, that was in August, in October my kids took me to my first Al-Anon conference down in Eufaula, and I went down there with Pat and Regina, and the first Al-Anon speaker I ever got to hear was Sue Drum. And Sue Drum stood up at the podium like this, and if all y'all know Sue Drum, you know what I heard. And she said, you go home and you take recovery in that home, because if there's not recovery in that home, there ain't any recovery. She said things like, you go home and when they say something that aggravates you a little bit, you look them straight in the eye and you say you could be right, because maybe they're right, and then you pray. And she began to say those kind of things, and I began to listen a little bit. And I never will forget it. I went home and Carl said something that vexed me. And I looked at him and I said, you could be right. And I'm not kidding you, his jaw fell about right there. And then I got up and I went down the hall and I got out on my knees and I said, Lord, will you shut my mouth? Now see, prior to that, I would have went down there and said, now Lord, if you'll get his mouth shut, I'll straighten him out here. But I began to ask God to straighten me out. And I left Carl to God. And so, that's how I started in this program. And things began to get better. My kids began to bring some sober alcoholics home at holidays. Mike's still out there drinking, and he's drinking and drugging bad. He got sober up in Ohio, and he stayed sober for about a year, and he moved home, and he moved right down the road from us. And see, Mike's my baby boy, and he's my youngest kid, and he's my funnest kid. God, have a good time with Mike. And he moved right down the road from us, and him and Carl, they kind of, you know, the healing came in our home, but it came real slow. It wasn't a matter of, I'm sorry. That wasn't good enough, because we'd all said that before so many times it was stale. It was, we showed people with the way we acted and how we changed, and the healing took place. And there was some healing taking place in my house. And that was about 4 years ago Mike came home. And he lived right down the road, and him and Carl started a little dog project together. They were raising some running dogs. And every morning Mike would come up to the house and we'd drink coffee and we'd go out and do some chores and we'd laugh and Mike would shoot me at the water hose or rope me at the rope and we'd just do all kinds of things. It was funny, we thought. We just had the best time ever was in the world. And then one day, he was gone again. You know, that disease called him. And he left. And he went up to Tulsa, and he had his back operated on again. It was about the third time, and prescription drugs had become a problem with along with the alcohol by that time. And he was crazy, and he was dying. And I'd been here 4 years, and I doubted me and you and the book and God. And I doubted. I began to think again. You know, my old thinking came back. And I began to think that I could do this. And they were telling me I had to leave him alone. And I didn't think I could. And God had let me see a miracle by that time. You know, I forgot to tell you. I'll back up and tell you about it the first time. And my boy Pat got married down in Fort Smith, Arkansas. And we all went. And we were standing down there, and my boy Pat, you know, he was standing up there getting married, and the little girl, 9 years old, was standing there beside him, his little daughter. He drank the first 4 years of her life, and she was scared of him because he'd drink, and she'd hide. And he'd come in, and he'd be drunk, and he'd say, "You come out of that closet, and you stand right here in front of me." And she's scared of him. And she looked at her daddy that day like, gosh, I never will forget it. God let me look back and see where we come from, just as plain as I see y'all. And there she stood, and she was just looking up at her daddy, just adoring. And I knew that this program had healed that relationship. And my big old daddy was standing over there, and the tears, my daddy was 6'4" and weighed 260 pounds, and he was standing there that day, and the tears were just rolling. And he was watching that sober young man get married. And I remembered how that day up in that courthouse in 1971, my big old daddy had stood up there with that money in one hand and a fist like this in the other, and he said to that judge in that chamber, "Are you sure you've got the right kid?" He couldn't believe it. And that little old mother of mine, she's real short, and I remembered how she told me how she ran out in the road and stopped that pickup and took that tiny little baby out of that drunken young man's arms. And there Regina was, you know, there she stood, that little thing. She was just gorgeous. She had a purple dress. My little teacher, the girl that introduced me to this program, beautiful within and without because y'all did that to her. And you see, she's the kind of drunk that she don't care if you puke on her. She's one of those kind of drunks that still will go and stretch out her hand and try to help pull you in. Thank God for people like that, because you're still out there trying to help my boy. You're not one of those kind that says, if they want it, they know where to find us. Thank God you're still out there looking for those kind that need help. And she was one of those. And then there was Carl that day, and Carl was crying, and he went over there, and he put his arms around that big old Pat, and he hugged him, and he told him how much he loved him. That's the man that used to go out and shake his finger in that boy's face and tell him to get the hell off his land. And he was loving that boy that day. And that was the first miracle. But I came home from my meeting on a Tuesday night after that first 4 years, and there was Pat's car sitting in my driveway, and I went in, and I was so scared. And Pat and Carl and Pat were sitting there at the table, and I said to Carl, "What happened?" And Carl said, I called him to come home, Jim, because I didn't know what else to do. See, Carl was scared too, and I didn't know he was scared. Because the reason I didn't know it, I was too busy looking at myself. And the sad part about that is, I was on my knees every morning saying, "God, relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do your will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over there may bear witness of your love and your power." See, I was doing that every morning because Ramona told me to. And I was doing what Ramona told me to do. But I wasn't doing it in my heart, because if I had been doing it in my heart, I would still have, I would have seen. But I didn't see, so God used this. And so Carl was sitting there, and he said, "I had to have help." And so I called Pat to come home and help me. I don't know what to do about that boy. That's how we described Mike, as that boy. He's going to die. He's going to die up there. I don't know what to do. And I sat down there with Pat, and I said, "I got to go get him and bring him home." See, I'm the kind of mother that'll push a kid in a wheelchair when he don't need pushing. And somebody walks up and they say, "How come your boy can't, I'm sorry, your boy can't walk?" And my reply, "He can walk, he don't have to." See, I didn't know that I was supposed to leave Mike alone and and give him the dignity of going through this stuff and suffering through this stuff until he came out alive. And I was going to go get him, and I was going to bring him home one more time. Wasn't going to listen to y'all. And Pat said to me, "Mama, you have got to leave that boy alone." And I said, "He's going to die." And he said, "He may."
He may die in this disease. The reality of this disease is it kills. It kills people and it kills relationships and it kills souls. And Mike may die in this disease, but God don't need you up there doing his stuff. All mamas and daddies, listen to this. God don't need you up there fixing that kid. Leave them alone. God has people to reach people. God uses people to reach people. He doesn't need us to do that. He just needs us to ask him for his will to be done and to accept the reality that we're dealing with a disease that kills people. And ours may be one of them. But it is not in vain. No, it's not. And so, I got ready to go to bed that night. And I walked down the hall and I looked back and there's Pat and Carl and they're still crying and they're still talking. And an amends of a sort was being made that night between that young man and that daddy. And I saw for the first time what I'd done to that man. I looked back and God let me see myself and what I had done. And how I had stripped him of every fiber of dignity that he owned. I had stripped away everything he had a right to. See, I did not know that my kids were drinking because they had a hole in their belly. And I was acting like a crazy person because I had a hole in my belly. And my husband was raging because he didn't know what else to do. And I made my mind up that night that if God would give me the opportunity that I would make amends to him the rest of my life. And I try to do that on a daily basis. And I didn't go to him and say, I'm sorry. I do it by letting him say what he wants to say and think what he wants to think. And I just look at him and say, you could be right. And I mean it because you know he could be right. He is right most of the time. If I had just listened to him, I was not able to listen. And so I went to work the next morning and I'm in my office out on a dead end street and a man, a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, come walking down that hall with a Coke in his hand. And I say to him, what are you doing out here? And he said, I have no idea. I started my office, which is on the south end of town. I'm living on the north end of town. I thought I'd drive out here and see what's in this old empty building. He didn't know I was in that old empty building. I'm going to tell you something. These are not coincidences. Coincidences don't happen in this program. Miracles happen in this program. And I said to that man, I believe I know what you're here for. Come on in. And he came in, we locked the door, and he sat out beside me, and he held my hand. I told him where I was that day, what was going on, how I had to go get that boy before the day was out, and bring him home and save him. And that man once again reaffirmed to me what you all have told me so many times. He prayed with me, he stayed with me for some 2-3 hours. And I was able to leave town that day and leave my boy behind and leave him in the hands of a loving and a caring and a merciful God. And I believe today if I'd have went up there and got that boy and brought him home and done what I wanted to, I'd have killed him. I don't think that boy could have survived me anymore. I thought the worst was over. I thought surely the worst was over. I came home, I dug into this program a little bit more, and they told me to be open-minded and be teachable, and I tried to be more and more that way. I began to go to more things and do more things and pray harder and read more and try to keep my hands off my boy. My boy came home and he moved down to Dallas. And he sobered up a little while. And sometimes we go to conferences like this, and we all go. And sometimes he's sober and he comes home and we have such a good time. And then that disease calls him again and he goes. And I had so many fears, you know, I lived with those fears for so many years. And I never will forget, you know, I would lay down at night and my head would spin. And I would think of things like this. Now I know what's going to happen. Somebody in my bunch is going to die. And when they die, I can't find my kids. And when I do find them, I probably won't recognize them. And if I do recognize them, they won't have any fit clothes to wear. And I'll have to take them town, buy them some good clothes, wear at the funeral. I had the whole thing planned out. I came home from a meeting on the 18th day of May in 1993, and my husband was standing in the driveway with his hat and his boots on, and I knew something had happened, and he said, "Hurry, June, your daddy's had a heart attack." Lord, that big old man that had made me feel so safe and so comfortable. And we rushed up to the hospital, and that little old girl of mine, she was there first, and she ran outside, and she put her arms around me, and she prayed with me, and she told me he was gone. And she stepped to the phone, and she called her little brother, and her brother down in Arkansas, and he was, of course, he was sober, and he came home. And Mike was on one of his sober spells about that time, and she called him, and he came home. And so once again, you know, we were all together. They were all sober. I didn't have to take them town, buy them any clothes, didn't have to clean them up, didn't have to do anything. They carried their granddaddy in honor and in dignity because of you to his grave. And so what I always say about that is, don't tell me it don't pay to worry. Everything I ever worried about never happened. So I figure that must be what happened. And I worried myself into it. But anyway, Mike, back in the fall, right before Christmas, we got a call, and they told us that Mike was in a hospital in a lockup ward down in Dallas. And it tells us in the promises in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous that we will intuitively know. And somehow, because I stayed close to you, and I knew, and I was not afraid. You see, that you remember when I told you about the first time my boy called me and needed help, and I was afraid. I couldn't tell my husband. And I hung up the phone, and he said, "Who was that?" And I said, "It was a doctor down in Dallas, Carl. They found Mike laying in the streets, and they took him, and he's in a lockup down there. And I don't know for sure what we should do about that." And Carl said, "June, call Pat and Regina." And I called them, and they come home. And the four of us, you know, we were able to sit there at the table, and we talked about it, and we prayed a little, and we talked and we prayed. And it became our decision to do nothing, to leave him in the hands of God and you. And so that's what we did. It was close to, this was last year after the first of the year, maybe it was about this time, because it was near Father's Day. And on Father's Day, he called, and he said to his daddy in his little slurred voice, "I love you, Daddy, and I miss you." And you know, Carl didn't hang that phone up and say, "He's drunk." Carl hung the phone up, and he said, "My God, that boy, what will ever happen to him?" See, he loved him. He said, "I love you back, Mike." That's this program working in our lives, in our home. And so Mike got out of there, and he sobered up a little bit, and we went to a conference or two together. He came home Christmas, and gosh, he was fine. We had a good time at Christmas again. We don't do presents anymore. I don't buy for them. We just have Christmas. We just sit around and talk, enjoy each other in fellowship. So much has changed at our house. And then shortly after Christmas, about a week after Christmas, that phone rang again, and it was the doctor one more time, and he said, "Your boy is in really, really bad shape." He said, "In the last few days, he's straight-lined 9 times. I don't know how he's alive. I don't know what to do with him. We can't turn him loose because we've got him on so much Valium, trying to get him off those DTs. We can't turn him loose. We don't know what to do." And so once again, I told my husband, unafraid, and once again, we called the kids to come home. And we sat down and we talked. And this time, we said, "We'll go get him." And we went down and got him, and we found a place down in Arkansas that takes low-bottom drunks. And we took him down there. And it was a painful experience. And he stayed down there for 30 days. And he came out, and he came back to Tulsa, and I picked him up at the airport, and he stayed with me for a day or two. And I had to talk at a conference in Dallas, and he went with me to Dallas. He stayed in the hotel with me, and we had the best time. Once again, we had the best time. I'm happy to report to y'all today. A boy called me yesterday from Dallas. He's working, and he's sober, one day at a time. You know, we don't ever know where that miracle is. We don't ever know. And all I know is I have to stay in a place to where when that moment of clarity comes to me, I'm able to do what I'm supposed to do. Maybe next time, if there is a next time, it'll be leave him alone. Maybe next time it'll be try to help. I don't know. I don't try to figure it out anymore. I try to truly do what you all tell me to do and what God's will is for my life. I know that this program, the power of this program is absolutely awesome. The power of prayer and the power of you people is awesome. Many places I go and people will tell me, I'm going to pray for your family and for your boy. And I know they are. And it's working. I think it's working. You know, I think that there isn't anything new under the sun. I think that over 2,000 years ago, a man stood on a hilltop and he told a simple message, a simple story to a group of people. And I think the miracle of it all is that Bill Wilson sobered up enough to hear it. And Bill Wilson then, through what I believe is divine intervention, wrote down those 12 steps that we use today. And that you also generously and lovingly passed on to people like me. I think that without them, wonder where we'd all be. I think that in my little book here, it tells me, there's a little page right here that says, He has delivered my soul in peace from the battles that were against me. And there were many with me. I think that this morning my cup is full, and so I drink from the saucer because of places like this and people like you. I'd like to close with a little story that's true. My husband and me always showed horses, and I was the turnback help. My husband showed cutting horses. We used to come off down here. I was the turnback help. Turnback help sets out in front of the cutter and gets all the verbal abuse if you're his wife. And I got sick and tired of that. And I decided I didn't want to do that anymore. I wanted to learn to ride a cutting horse on my own. And so my husband bought me a little old mare. And I had the boots and the spurs and the hat and the shabs and the whole nine yards. And my husband sent me off to an old champion, an old man that was a championship world championship cutting horse man, Mr. Pat Patterson from Tecumseh, Oklahoma. Had won many awards. Dear friend of ours. And I went over there and I stayed with him for weeks. And he took me out every day and he taught me and he taught me and he taught me. And I'd fall off and I'd get back up and I'd get back on. And I'd try again, and he'd tell me again, tell me again, tell me again. And one day it came time for me to go show my mare. And I was so scared. So scared. I knew I was going to fall off. I knew I wouldn't do it right. And my husband and Mr. Pat was there, and Mr. Pat and my husband called me off to the side. And there's, you know, the two men set out front, turn back help. Man on either side of you, that's the herd holders. Herd holders sit over there and they talk to you and they tell you and they help you. And my husband said, now June, me and Mr. Pat's going to be in the corner. I'll be in one corner, he'll be in the other. And you don't have to be afraid. Now he said, you can ride that mare. You go in there, you ride in there, June, and you scoot way down on your pockets and you relax. You give that mare her head and let her work. Trust her. Let her work. and you listen. And I'll talk you through it. You listen. And I was talking like this one time at a place, and that thing came to my mind. And I thought, Lord, have mercy, that's all it is. You know, God does that every day. He says, June, I've sent you to the very, very best, the old masters, and that's y'all. And I gave you the very best set of tools there is, and that's these 12 steps and 12 traditions in the books. And he said, all you have to do, June, is get up every day and trust me and let me work. You trust me and you let me work. And if you'll listen, I'll be over there in the corner and I'll talk you through it. And he talks me through it every day of the world. And he'll talk you through it too. God bless y'all. Thanks again. Thank you.